Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and this is episode number 164 for September 21st, 2008, with special coverage of Whiskey Live Paris. As we heard from Aberlauer's Ann Miller in the last episode, France is actually the largest market for Scotch whiskey exports, even bigger than the U.S. As a result, distillers travel from all over the world to this festival, and we'll hear from some of them in this special episode. Well, let's start off with one that's about to celebrate a milestone. Islay's Kilhoman Distillery is counting the days until December, when the first new make spirit it produced in 2005 becomes 3 years old. That's when it can legally be called Scotch whiskey, and while there will be a party to celebrate, Anthony Wills won't be bottling it right away.
We're going to bottle a little off next year, 2009, probably September 2009, just to whet people's appetite for what to look forward to in the future.
How much longer do you think it needs before you can really take it to the market?
Well, that's a $1 million question. I mean, I think it's... We're thinking that it's going to be for earlier maturation than say 10, 15, 20 years, but it's still. I think we believe that if we release it at sort of 5 or 6 years, it'll be a very nice, pleasant young age malt, but obviously a little bit more aged and it'll be a lot better. So when it's going to be its ultimate, who knows at this stage? But maybe between 8 and 10 years, it'll be the sort of.
Can you see yourself doing like a couple of the other distilleries have done and releasing it in stages just to let people get a taste for it as it develops?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, I mean, obviously our market is the sort of whiskey enthusiast, the connoisseur end of them. And I think they appreciate the evolution of whiskey as it develops. And I think what we're looking to do is to release at a young age and then do small releases at 5, maybe 8, and so on. So, yes, the intention is to attract a following from whiskey enthusiasts who appreciate and understand what we're looking to do, and with our unique selling point being that we're growing the barley on the farm at the distillery and doing the whole production process on site. It's something unique and different, and it's a bit special. We can hang our hat on that.
And this has got to really be an exciting time for you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been quite a steep learning curve up until now. I mean, I've been putting this together since 2001. We built the distillery and got into production 2005, and you know, it's great to be at this stage when we can actually now show people, you know, what we're doing.
How has the spirit matured so far?
Well, we're very pleased with its maturation. I'm not an expert master distiller, but I've got lots of people behind me who are very experienced. Jim Swan is my production consultant, who's hugely experienced, and he does all my wood policy and cask purchasing. And his opinion and other people have been very complimentary about the quality of the spirit at you know, off the stills, and as it's maturing now that we're showing, you know, our 2.5-year-old here, and just the difference between the new spirit and the 2.5 years in a fresh bourbon cask is quite stark, and people see that it's actually making good progress, and that actually as a young new spirit it's actually very appealing, and you know, the quality is good. So that gives us a lot of confidence going forward, and that you know, we'll have something out there that people are going to be interested in purchasing.
What's been the best part of this so far?
I think when we got the first spirit running through the stills, when, you know, after all the hard work and heartache of things going wrong and not quite getting enough money together, and then actually achieving that was a goal. That was the first goal, and that was hugely exciting. But now, as we get closer to the stage when we can actually release a single malt, you know, that'll be the next stage for us as a distillery. You know, getting to that stage will be hugely exciting for us. Yeah.
Phase Isle next May ought to be pretty interesting, since you guys will actually be able to join the single malt club next year, right?
Yeah, and I think the intention is that the Whiskey Fest, Islay Whiskey Festival in May, we will do a little bottling for the festival people who come to the distillery. They'll be able to take away a pretty unique bottling, but you have to come to the festival to get one.
Anthony was pouring both new make spirit right off the still and 2.5-year-old spirit aged in bourbon casks. While it still needs some more maturing, Kilhoman's got something worth watching for down the road. Another distillery to keep an eye on is Glendronach. Its booth was side by side with Benriach, especially appropriate since the two are now under the same ownership, and Billy Walker has plans to let Glendronach blossom.
Well, our plans are to give it back its personality and its soul. And this was a fantastic, historically, this has been a very, very interesting distillery. And indeed, 40 years ago, this would be in the top five single malts in the world. So we know that this distillery has the ability to rediscover its personality, and that's the plan. We'll introduce a 15-year-old, 18-year-old, probably a 40-year-old, and we'll select some very unique casks, and we'll have a vintage offering of single cask bottlings.
One of the parallels that I've sort of drawn between what you're doing now with Glendronach is what happened several years ago with Glen Grant once Campari took it over and got it out from under a massive corporation and was able to actually do some interesting things with it and sort of free it up from the, for lack of a better term, the corporate umbrella and put it back in the hands of the distillers and the guys who, the people with the passion for making whiskey. And it seems like that's been the case with your folks, with you guys at Benriach, and now with Glendronach. It seems that that's the case to put the passion back into the product. Is that really the case here?
Well, I think that's, I mean, that's kind of the business model we will follow. I mean, for sure, there will be a huge passion surrounding the brand. And the brand will be allowed to express itself again. It won't just be something else in the range. This will be a very an opportunity to give huge focus to the brand, but also to personalise it, to bring it into the top, move it successively into the kind of premium end of the market, and focus on the boutique end. That's where we're strong. We understand that end of the market. We don't understand big multiple retailing, but we do understand the requirements of the independent sector of the market.
One of the first releases under Billy Walker's leadership will likely be a 1972 single cask bottling. I had the chance to try it, and it's just amazing. Look for the tasting notes and the rating later on the ratings page of the Whiskey Cast website. And if you want a parallel to what the future holds for Glendronach, look at Glen Grant. It's purchased by Campari a couple of years ago. Let distillery manager Dennis Malcolm do just what Billy Walker plans to do now.
It's like walking in a field with no fence round about it. You know, the world's our oyster now, because we were limited to different markets before, and rightly so. But now Campari own us. We are doing special expressions, just small limited expressions, to let people see the length and the depth of Glen Grant, so that we're not just a standard young 5-year-old malt for Italy and 10 for the home market. We've got 15, we've got 25, but we're building up stocks for the future, and we're also doing little expressions of cask strengths and different finishes. In the next few years, we're going to be releasing maybe one or two a year, just to let people keep an interest in Glen Grant and see what Glen Grant can actually do.
Because this has really sort of been an underrated malt for many years, right?
Yeah, it was the biggest single malt in any country. You know, it was Italy. It was 500,000 cases some 10 years ago. But it's been kept in the sidelines all the time. You know, now we're set free, and we can actually do what we wish. You know, we can challenge the world now, and I find this very exciting to do that.
What about your plans to get into the U.S. and other world markets?
We have plans for that. We're actively talking just now and looking at launching in the U.S. maybe late spring, early summer next year with a 10-year-old Glen Grant, because we're not in the U.S. But we're going to be very careful on how we do it, because we don't have huge stocks. We had a limited stock purchase of stocks from Chivas Pernod, so we're actively building up our stocks for the future. So we've got to be careful how we expand.
And careful expansion is important. That's a lesson the guys at Ireland's Cooley Distillery learned the hard way with their Green Ore grain whiskey.
We're almost a victim of our own success. We weren't exactly sure how well the market would take to the single grain. It's been an absolute revelation since it's come out. You know, we had to sort of tide it over, because we laid down some new stock that's coming out in November for the Green Ore 8 and made a limited edition release of the Green Ore 15. You know, especially in America, there's a huge appetite for the Green Ore, and I think a lot of people will be watching for it to come out in November.
Watch for a sherry cask version of Cooley's Connemara peated whiskey sometime next spring. Speaking of sherry casks, Michael Urquhart of Gordon and MacPhail poured a 1964 Strathyla Glenlivet and a 1972 Capperdonnick, both aged in first fill sherry casks, both amazing, along with the new Benromic Origins range.
Whiskies are some of all parts, and in the first edition of Origins, we're saying that the telling people about the barley that's been used. It's Golden Promise barley, matured in first fill sherry casks. So you get a beautiful sweet note coming through, some lovely fruits coming through. Just all in all, a beautiful whiskey. It really is nice, and get some citrus as well. And that's one of the things that's interesting about Benromic, is when you look at the old distillation, because we bought the distillery in 93, took 5 years to redevelop because it had been closed in 83. When you look at the old distillation and the new distillation, there's a signature of chocolate and fruit coming through. And both, but the only consistent part is the water, the wooden washbacks, the filling and receiving vats. Everything else is different and new.
And so you guys are really celebrating the 15th anniversary now of buying the distillery.
Yeah, of buying it. We hadn't looked at it that way, actually.
Anniversary of reopening.
Yeah, it was October 98 when it was officially reopened by Prince Charles. So, yeah, watch the space. We should be coming out with a 10-year-old soon. But the one thing will be quality. That's going to be the driving force in this. We're going to want to make sure that we're giving a good expression of Benromic.
And you'll be coming out, obviously, with older expressions now that you have the ability to do so, right?
We've always had whiskey. Benromic's one that we filled before as an independent bottling site and bottled under Connoisseur's Choice. So we had stocks available. We have 21 or 25, vintage 68, stroke 69, and we have a 55-year-old, although it's incredibly rare. So we have whiskies from the old distillation and the new distillation available now. So there's quite a range there for a whiskey that's so young. But, you know, it's in some ways it's strange in that, you know, we're developing a brand that is effectively over 100 years old. But, of course, Benromic wasn't sold as a single malt until original bottling, distiller's bottling, until we took it over. So that's exciting. It's great fun going and doing it and promoting it around about the world.
What's new on the Gordon and MacPhail side from the independents?
Oh, well, we keep on adding to the Connoisseur's Choice range. Obviously, with the listeners in America, that range is slightly different to the rest of the world because we've got to do special bottlings there. But really, it's just kind of coming out with some new bottlings there. And there's always something quite exciting.
What about the rest of the world, since the show is heard worldwide?
I'm trying to remember the new Connoisseur's Choice ones. With a range of over 300 products, it's always difficult to remember what's new and what's old. We've got some Arran there, which we took out last year, which is a new addition. There's some Inchgower, just to name a couple. As I say, we've got over 300 different expressions of whiskey, so it's not a case of what's new. It's discovering this Aladdin's cave of what's there, and you can go and try. And you know, we've got whiskies going back from 1936 all the way through to young 5-6-year-old whiskey. So massive, massive range. It doesn't necessarily need to be new.
Now, of course, whiskey festivals are more than just about tasting whiskies. Several authors showed their new whiskey books for the fall lineup. Hans Ofringa offered two new books, A Taste of Whiskey and The Legend of Laphroaig.
One of my friends in the whiskey world is Marcel van Gils. He's a dentist, but apart from that, he's the largest Laphroaig collector in the world. And he approached me 2 years ago with the idea of making a book out of his collection. So we sat down and he said, Hans, I know a lot about Laphroaig, and you can write, let's team up. So we decided to make a book not only about his collection, but embedded in the history of the distillery. So we wrote to Laphroaig Distillery itself. They were very enthusiastic about it. We went to Fortune Brands, Beam Global, who is the owner of Laphroaig, and we were met with instant enthusiasm, and they opened up the archives just for us. And they closed them for other people so we could work on them archives. And we went to the distillery itself to do extensive research, but also to Glasgow University, where they keep all the records. And we found amazing stuff there. I work together with my wife. We are known as the whiskey couple. She's American, so she masters the English language even much better than I do, and helps with research, but also with editing my English writing.
What will people find in this book?
Well, they will find at first, the first chapter deals with the history of distilling. It takes you into the next chapter by suggesting, well, distilling might have come to Scotland via Islay. So the second chapter is about the Isle of Islay and the history in a nutshell. Then we move on to the distillery, the history of the distillery, and there you will learn how the two founding brothers decided one of them would leave, and the other one bought his shares, and he disappeared. But we found in the archives where the brother went to Australia, and Marcel found via the web the descendants of one of the founders, and he got in touch with them, and they helped us tremendously with making the whole family tree complete. So you will find the entire family tree, but also unique documents describing the actual value of the company, the stories about Bessie Williamson, who took over the distillery, the first female to own and manage a distillery. And then the last chapter is about the collection of Marcel. You will see a selection of his huge collection of Lafroig bottles from the early 20th century up till now. And it's not confined to his house anymore. It's now open to the public. They can see it in the book.
And this is a story you really can't tell without Bessie Williamson in there, right?
No, you can't. You can't go around her. She's larger than life, or she was larger than life. And she was not only a very conscientious person, but if you read what she did for the people way back when, in the 40s and 50s, there were no pension plans, but she took care of the people who had to retire because of health reasons. And she was always very interested in helping the people out. So it was not only about making money on distilling whiskey, but caring for the people. Beautiful stories about that, yeah.
Now, let's talk about your other book, A Taste of Whiskey.
Well, A Taste of Whiskey is the first book in a series of books I'm currently writing about whiskey and the senses. So this is a story, a book about how whiskey gets its taste. I take the reader by the hand and take him or her through a distillery. There's beautiful pictures in it from a friend of ours who is a professional photographer. And I explain in every stage of the process where the actual aromas come into being. The second part of the book, I invited four chefs from Scotland, from France, from Belgium and the Netherlands, and I presented them 10 single malts. Of course, these 10 single malts are in the book, but I asked them to prepare a 10-course dinner with these 10 single malts. I was hoping they would take an entirely different approach each, and that happened. And the interesting thing is, at the end of the chapter, they all explain in their own words why they made these combinations. And one uses Ardbeg with a starter, another with a dessert, one uses Dalwhinnie with the main course, and another with a dessert again. It's fabulous to see how different people from different countries use the same single malt whiskies to create an entirely different 10-course dinner.
Now, where can people order these books?
They can order them via our website. We are trying to set up a distribution system for the U.S., but for us that's rather difficult from, well, we currently live in the Netherlands, tiny country. We don't have that long reach. So we are currently looking for partners who are interested in distributing, wholesalers and distributors of the book in the U.S. There is something coming on there because the second book in the series will be released early spring in the U.S. first, and it's called Whiskey and Jazz, and it's about listening and drinking whiskey. So I hope that we'll get some traction on the book. In the meantime, both for The Legend of Lafroig and A Taste of Whiskey, we keep searching for people who would like to take these books on.
What's the website for people all over the world who would want to order it?
Thewhiskeycouple.com. It is bilingual in Dutch and English. And the other website is lafroigcollector.com.
There's a link to order both books at the WhiskeyCast website, and I'll have an interview with Marcel Van Gils on an upcoming episode of WhiskeyCast. I've mentioned fellow malt maniac Ulf Buxrud's new book on Japanese whiskeys in past episodes of WhiskeyCast. The book is out now, and I had the chance to catch up with Ulf today.
The new book is a compilation of a journey to Japan with my wife a year ago. And we had a goal to visit 10 distilleries during 10 days and sample at least 100 Japanese single malt whiskey. But I failed gravely. It became 114.
114 in 10 days?
In 10 days, yes, sir.
And for most people who don't really understand Japanese whiskeys, one would find it hard to believe that there are 114 different Japanese whiskeys, but in fact there are many that we've not ever heard of, right?
So that gives me a reason to return, which I will do in February next year to compile the remaining ones.
Tell me sort of what you discovered during your journey.
As a matter of fact, there is an individual characteristics, a fingerprint in Japanese whiskey, which you don't find in Scottish whiskey or in German whiskeys. They are not copycats. They'll find their national identity in their whiskeys. Some of them taking impression from the wood they are matured in, like Japanese casks. And there you have almost an Asian temple with the incense and that kind of thing. So you can imagine these Japanese temples in the Japanese whiskies.
Now, you also not just cover the whiskey, but you also talk about whiskey shops. You also have guides for people, a guide for people who really want to go over and explore for themselves,
right? As a matter of fact, I try to cover the segment fully, not only from the manufacturing point of view, but also for the people who is traveling with an enthusiast and not like me at all. So I'm giving a tour book as well, what you can experience in the vicinity of each distillery, if your time permits. But they're also covering whiskey bars, trade shows, publication, and even giving an itinerary how to travel in Japan to visit all these distilleries, given the distance and means of transportation. So I think it's some sort of a definitive guide to Japanese whiskies. I also measured, for instance, with looking at the technical side, all the individual installation, not with a measurement tape like Bernard did, but you have everything from the angle on the line arms to the size of the pot stills from every distillery.
Ulf's book is available through the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com. You'll find it at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and that's also where you'll find the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Coming up over the next few weeks, the U.S. chapter of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society starts its fall series of single malt dinners in Chicago on October 2nd. Whiskey Messen is in Copenhagen, Denmark on October 4th, along with the Whiskey Weekend Bremen in Bremen, Germany on the 4th and 5th, and Whiskey Live Barcelona on the 5th and 6th. Milroy's of Soho in London will hold a tasting of peated whiskies on the 8th, and the Royal Mile Whiskies store in London will hold a tasting on the 9th. Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest San Francisco is October 10th. That's the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay at Laphroaig.com. And that's all for this special episode of WhiskeyCast from Whiskey Live Paris. Special thanks go to Whiskey Magazine France and La Maison du Whiskey for their hospitality. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008. I'm Mark Gillespie, and from Paris, au revoir.